profoundly stuck, then you may be much better off than when it was loaded with ideas. The solution to the problem often at first seems unimportant or undesirable, but the state of stuckness allows it, in time, to assume its true importance. It seemed small because your previous rigid evaluation, which led to the stuckness, made it small. But now consider the fact that no matter how hard you try to hang on to it, this stuckness is bound to disappear. Your mind will naturally and freely move toward a solution. Unless you are a real master at staying stuck, you can't prevent this. The fear of stuckness is needless, because the longer you stay stuck, the more you see the quality reality that gets you unstuck every time. What's really been getting you stuck is the running from the stuckness through the cars of your train of knowledge, looking for a solution that is out in front of the train. Stuckness shouldn't be avoided. It's the physic predecessor of all real understanding. An egoless acceptance of stuckness is a key to an understanding of all quality, in mechanical work as in other endeavors. It's this understanding of quality, as revealed by stuckness, which so often makes self-taught mechanics so superior to institute-trained men who have learned how to handle everything except a new situation. Normally, screws are so cheap and small and simple you think of them as unimportant. But now, as your quality awareness becomes stronger, you realize that this one individual particular screw is neither cheap nor small nor unimportant. Right now, this screw is worth exactly the selling price of the whole motorcycle, because the motorcycle is actually valueless until you get the screw out. With this reevaluation of the screw comes a willingness to expand your knowledge of it. With the expansion of the knowledge, I would guess, would come a reevaluation of what the screw really is. If you concentrate on it, think about it, stay stuck on it for a long enough time, I would guess that in time, you will come to see that the screw is less and less an object typical of a class, and more an object unique in itself. Then, with more concentration, you will begin to see the screw as not even an object at all, but as a collection of functions. Your stuckness is gradually eliminating patterns of traditional reason. In the past, when you separated subject and object from one another in a permanent way, your thinking about them got very rigid. You formed a class called screw that seemed to be inviolable and more real than the reality you are looking at. And you couldn't think of how to get unstuck because you couldn't think of anything new, because you couldn't see anything new. Now, in getting that screw out, you aren't interested in what it is. What it is has ceased to be a category of thought and is a continuing direct experience. It's not in the boxcars anymore. It's out in front and capable of change. You are interested in what it does and why it's doing it. You will ask functional questions. Associated with your questions will be a subliminal quality discrimination, identical to the quality discrimination that led Poincaré to the Fuchsian equations. What your actual solution is unimportant as long as it has quality. Thoughts about the screw as combined rigidness and adhesiveness and about its special helical interlock might lead naturally to solutions of impaction and use of solvents. That is one kind of quality track. Another track may be to go to the library and look through a catalog of mechanics tools in which you might come across a screw extractor that would do the job, or to call a friend who knows something about mechanical work, or to just drill the screw out or just burn it out with a torch. Or you might just, as a result of your meditative attention to the screw, come up with some new way of extracting it that has never been thought of before, and that beats all the rest, and is patentable, and makes you a millionaire 5 years from now. There's no predicting what's on that quality track. The solutions all are simple, after you have arrived at them. But they're simple only when you know already what they are. Highway 13 follows another branch of our river, but now it goes upstream past old sawmill towns and sleepy scenery. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 8, Side 1. Highway 13 follows another branch of our river, but now it goes upstream past old sawmill towns and sleepy scenery. Sometimes when you switch from a federal to a state highway, it seems like you drop back like this in time. Pretty mountains, pretty river, bumpy but pleasant tar road. Old buildings, old people on a front porch. Strange how old, obsolete buildings and plants and mills, the technology of 50 and 100 years ago, always seem to look so much better than the new stuff. Weeds and grass and wildflowers grow where the concrete is cracked and broken. Neat, squared, upright lines acquire a random sag. The uniform masses of the unbroken color of fresh paint modify to a mottled, weathered softness. Nature has a non-Euclidean geometry of her own that seems to soften the deliberate objectivity of these buildings with a kind of random spontaneity that architects would do well to study. Soon we leave the river and the old sleepy buildings and now climb to some sort of a dry, meadowy plateau. The road rolls and bumps and rocks so much I have to keep the speed down to 50. There are some bad chuck holes in the asphalt, and I watch carefully for more. We're really accustomed to making mileage. Stretches that would have seemed long back in the Dakotas now seem short and easy. Being on the machine seems more natural than being off it. We're nowhere that I'm familiar with, in country that I've never seen before, yet I don't feel a stranger in it. At the top of the plateau at Grangeville, Idaho, we step from the blasting heat into an air-conditioned restaurant. Deep cool inside. While we wait for chocolate malteds, I notice a high schooler sitting at the counter exchanging looks with the girl next to him. She's gorgeous, and I'm not the only other one who notices it. The girl behind the counter waiting on them is also watching, with an anger she thinks no one else sees. Some kind of triangle. We keep passing unseen through little moments of other people's lives. Back in the heat again, and not far from Grangeville, we see that the dry plateau that looked almost like prairie when we were out on it suddenly breaks away into an enormous canyon. I see our road will go down and down, through what must be 100 hairpin turns, into a desert of broken land and crags. I tap Chris's knee and point, and as we round a turn, where we see it all, I hear him holler, "Wow!" At the brink, I shift down to third, then close the throttle. The engine drags, backfiring a little, and down we go. By the time our cycle has reached the bottom of wherever it is we are, we have dropped thousands of feet. I look back over my shoulder and see ant-like cars way back at the top. Now we must head forward across this baking desert to wherever the road leads. Chapter 25. This morning, a solution to the problem of stuckness was discussed, the classic badness caused by traditional reason. Now it's time to move to its romantic parallel, the ugliness of the technology traditional reason has produced. The road has twisted and rolled over desert hills into a little narrow thread of green surrounding the town of Whitebird, then proceeded on to a big fast river, the Salmon, flowing between high canyon walls. Here the heat is tremendous and the glare from the White Canyon rock is blinding. We wind on and on through the bottom of the narrow canyon, nervous about fast-moving traffic and oppressed by the fiery heat. The ugliness the Sutherlands were fleeing is not inherent in technology. It only seemed that way to them because it's so hard to isolate what it is within technology that's so ugly. But technology is simply the making of things, and the making of things can't by its own nature be ugly, or there would be no possibility for beauty in the arts, which also include the making of things. Actually, a root word of technology, techne, originally meant art. The ancient Greeks never separated art from manufacture in their minds, and so never developed separate words for them. Neither is the ugliness inherent in the materials of modern technology, a statement you sometimes hear. Mass-produced plastics and synthetics aren't in themselves bad. They've just acquired bad associations. A person who's lived inside stone walls of a prison most of his life is likely to see stone as inherently ugly material, even though it's also the prime material of sculpture, and a person who's lived in a prison of ugly plastic technology that started with his childhood toys and continues through a lifetime of junky consumer products is likely to see this material as inherently ugly. But the real ugliness of modern technology isn't found in any material or shape or act or product. These are just the objects in which the low quality appears to reside. It's our habit of assigning quality to subjects or objects that gives this impression. The real ugliness is not the result of any objects of technology, nor is it, if one follows Phaedrus's metaphysics, the result of any subjects of technology, the people who produce it, or the people who use it. Quality or its absence doesn't reside in either the subject or the object. The real ugliness lies in the relationship between the people who produce the technology and the things they produce, which results in a similar relationship between the people who use the technology and the things they use. Phaedrus felt that at the moment of pure quality perception, or not even perception, at the moment of pure quality, there is no subject and there is no object. There is only a sense of quality that produces a later awareness of subjects and objects. At the moment of pure quality, subject and object are identical. This is the tat tuam asi truth of the Upanishads, but it's also reflected in modern street argot. Getting with it, digging it, grooving on it are all slang reflections of this identity. It is this identity that is the basis of craftsmanship in all the technical arts. And it is this identity that modern, dualistically conceived technology lacks. The creator of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. The owner of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. The user of it feels no particular sense of identity with it. Hence, by Phaedrus's definition, it has no quality. That wall in Korea that Phaedrus saw was an act of technology. It was beautiful, but not because of any masterful intellectual planning or any scientific supervision of the job or any added expenditures to stylize it. It was beautiful because the people who worked on it had a way of looking at things that made them do it right unself-consciously. They didn't separate themselves from the work in such a way as to do it wrong. There is the center of the whole solution. The way to solve the conflict between human values and technological needs is not to run away from technology. That's impossible. The way to resolve the conflict is to break down the barriers of dualistic thought that prevent a real understanding of what technology is. Not an exploitation of nature, but a fusion of nature and the human spirit into a new kind of creation that transcends both. When this transcendence occurs in such events as the first airplane flight across the ocean or the first footstep on the moon, a kind of public recognition of the transcendent nature of technology occurs. But this transcendence should also occur at the individual level, on a personal basis, in one's own life, in a less dramatic way. The walls of the canyon here are completely vertical now. In many places, room for the road had to be blasted out of it. No alternate routes here, just whichever way the river goes. It may be just my imagination, but it seems the river is already smaller than it was an hour ago. Such personal transcendence of conflicts with technology doesn't have to involve motorcycles, of course. It can be at a level as simple as sharpening a kitchen knife, or sewing a dress, or mending a broken chair. The underlying problems are the same. In each case, there's a beautiful way of doing it, and an ugly way of doing it. And in arriving at the high-quality, beautiful way of doing it, both an ability to see what looks good and an ability to understand the underlying methods to arrive at that good are needed. Both classic and romantic understandings of quality must be combined. The nature of our culture is such that if you were to look for instruction in how to do any of these jobs, the instruction would always give only one understanding of quality, the classic. It would tell you how to hold the blade when sharpening the knife, or how to use a sewing machine, or how to mix and apply glue with the presumption that once these underlying methods were applied, good would naturally follow. The ability to see directly what looks good would be ignored. The result is rather typical of modern technology, an overall dullness of appearance so depressing that it must be overlaid with a veneer of style to make it acceptable. And that, to anyone who is sensitive to romantic quality, just makes it all the worse. Now it's just not depressingly dull, it's also phony. Put the two together, and you get a pretty accurate basic description of modern American technology. Stylized cars, and stylized outboard motors, and stylized typewriters, and stylized clothes. Stylized refrigerators filled with stylized food, and stylized kitchens in stylized houses. Plastic stylized toys for stylized children, who at Christmas and birthdays are in style with their stylish parents. You have to be awfully stylish yourself not to get sick of it once in a while. It's the style that gets you. Technological ugliness syruped over with romantic phoniness in an effort to produce beauty and profit by people who, though stylish, don't know where to start because no one has ever told them there's such a thing as quality in this world, and it's real, not style. Quality isn't something you lay on top of subjects and objects like tinsel on a Christmas tree. Real quality must be the source of the subjects and objects. The cone from which the tree must start. To arrive at this quality requires a somewhat different procedure from the step one, step two, step three instructions that accompany dualistic technology, and that's what I'll now try to go into. After many turns in the canyon wall, we stop for a break under a scrubby little patch of small trees and rocks. The grass around the trees is burned and browned and scattered with litter from picnickers. I collapse into some shade and after a while squint up at the sun, which I haven't really looked at since we entered this canyon. Up there above the canyon walls, it's cool and dark blue and far away. Chris doesn't even go over to see the river, something he'd normally do. Like me, he's tired and content just to sit under the scant shade of these trees. After a while, he says there's an old iron pump, it looks like, between us and the river. He points to it, and I see what he means. He goes over, and I can see him pump water onto his hand and then splash it onto his face. I go over and pump for him, so he can use both hands. Then I do the same. The water feels cold in my hands and face. When done, we walk to the cycle again, and climb on, and pull back onto the canyon road. Now that solution. Throughout this Chautauqua, so far, this whole problem of technological ugliness has been looked at in a negative way. It's been said that romantic attitudes toward quality, such as the Sutherlands have, are by themselves hopeless. You can't live on just groovy emotions alone. You have to work with the underlying form of the universe, too. The laws of nature, which, when understood, can make work easier, sickness rarer, and famine almost absent. On the other hand, technology based on pure dualistic reason has also been condemned because it obtains these material advantages by turning the world into a stylized garbage dump. Now's the time to stop condemning things and come up with some answers. The answer is Phaedrus's contention that classic understanding should not be overlaid with romantic prettiness. Classic and romantic understanding should be united at a basic level. In the past, our common universe of reason has been in the process of escaping, rejecting the romantic, irrational world of prehistoric man. It's been necessary since before the time of Socrates to reject the passions, the emotions, in order to free the rational mind for an understanding of nature's order, which was as yet unknown. Now it's time to further an understanding of nature's order by reassimilating those passions which were originally fled from. The passions, the emotions, the affective domain of man's consciousness, are a part of nature's order too, the central part. At present, we're snowed under with an irrational expansion of blind data gathering in the sciences, because there's no rational format for any understanding of scientific creativity. At present, we are also snowed under with a lot of stylishness in the arts, thin art, because there's very little assimilation or extension into underlying form. We have artists with no scientific knowledge and scientists with no artistic knowledge, and both with no spiritual sense of gravity at all. And the result is not just bad, it is ghastly. The time for real reunification of art and technology is really long overdue. At the DeWeese's, I started to talk about peace of mind in connection with technical work, but got laughed off the scene because I brought it up out of the context in which it had originally appeared to me. Now I think it is in context to return to peace of mind and see what I was talking about. Peace of mind isn't at all superficial to technical work. It's the whole thing. That which produces it is good work, and that which destroys it is bad work. The specs, the measuring instruments, the quality control, the final checkout, these are all means toward the end of satisfying the peace of mind of those responsible for the work. What really counts in the end is their peace of mind, nothing else. The reason for this is that peace of mind is a prerequisite for a perception of that quality which is beyond romantic quality and classic quality, and which unites the two, and which must accompany the work as it proceeds. The way to see what looks good and understand the reasons it looks good, and to be at one with this goodness as the work proceeds, is to cultivate an inner quietness, a peace of mind, so that goodness can shine through. I say inner peace of mind. It has no direct relationship to external circumstances. It can occur to a monk in meditation, to a soldier in heavy combat, or to a machinist taking off that last 1/10th of an inch. It involves unself-consciousness, which produces a complete identification with one's circumstances, and there are levels and levels of this identification, and levels of quietness, quite as profound and difficult of attainment as the more familiar levels of activity. The mountains of achievement are quality discovered in one direction only, and are relatively meaningless and often unobtainable unless taken together with the ocean trenches of self-awareness, so different from self-consciousness, which result from inner peace of mind. This inner peace of mind occurs on three levels of understanding. Physical quietness seems the easiest to achieve, although there are levels and levels of this, too, as attested by the ability of Hindu mystics to live buried alive for many days. Mental quietness, in which one has no wandering thoughts at all, seems more difficult, but can be achieved. But value quietness, in which one has no wandering desires at all, but simply performs the acts of his life without desire, that seems the hardest. I've sometimes thought this inner peace of mind, this quietness, is similar to, if not identical with, the sort of calm you sometimes get when going fishing, which accounts for much of the popularity of this sport. Just to sit with the line in the water, not moving, not really thinking about anything, not really caring about anything either, seems to draw out the inner tensions and frustrations that have prevented you from solving problems you couldn't solve before, and introduced ugliness and clumsiness into your actions and thoughts. You don't have to go fishing, of course, to fix your motorcycle. A cup of coffee, a walk around the block, sometimes just putting off the job for 5 minutes of silence is enough. When you do, you can almost feel yourself grow toward that inner peace of mind that reveals it all. That which turns its back on this inner calm and the quality it reveals is bad maintenance. That which turns toward it is good. The forms of turning away and toward are infinite, but the goal is always the same. I think that when this concept of peace of mind is introduced and made central to the act of technical work, a fusion of classic and romantic quality can take place at a basic level within a practical working context. I've said you can actually see this fusion in skilled mechanics and machinists of a certain sort, and you can see it in the work they do. To say that they are not artists is to misunderstand the nature of art. They have patience, care, and attentiveness to what they're doing. But more than this, there's a kind of inner peace of mind that isn't contrived, but results from a kind of harmony with the work in which there's no leader and no follower. The material and the craftsman's thoughts change together in a progression of smooth, even changes until his mind is at rest at the exact instant the material is right. We've all had moments of that sort when we're doing something we really want to do. It's just that somehow we've gotten into an unfortunate separation of these moments from work. The mechanic I'm talking about doesn't make this separation. One says of him that he is interested in what he's doing, that he's involved in his work. What produces this involvement is, at the cutting edge of consciousness, an absence of any sense of separateness of subject and object. Being with it, being a natural, taking hold, There are a lot of idiomatic expressions for what I mean by this absence of subject-object duality, because what I mean is so well understood as folklore, common sense, the everyday understanding of the shop. But in scientific parlance, the words for this absence of subject-object duality are scarce, because scientific minds have shut themselves off from consciousness of this kind of understanding in the assumption of the formal dualistic scientific outlook. Zen Buddhists talk about just sitting, a meditative practice in which the idea of a duality of self and object does not dominate one's consciousness. What I'm talking about here in motorcycle maintenance is just fixing, in which the idea of a duality of self and object doesn't dominate one's consciousness. When one isn't dominated by feelings of separateness from what he's working on, then one can be said to care about what he's doing. That is what caring really is, a feeling of identification with what one's doing. When one has this feeling, then he also sees the inverse side of caring, quality itself. So the thing to do when working on a motorcycle, as in any other task, is to cultivate the peace of mind which does not separate one's self from one's surroundings. When that is done successfully, then everything else follows naturally. Peace of mind produces right values produce right thoughts. Right thoughts produce right actions, and right actions produce work, which will be a material reflection for others to see, of the serenity at the center of it all. That was what it was about that wall in Korea. It was a material reflection of a spiritual reality. I think that if we are going to reform the world and make it a better place to live in, the way to do it is not with talk about relationships of a political nature, which are inevitably dualistic, full of subjects and objects and their relationship to one another, or with programs full of things for other people to do. I think that kind of approach starts at the end and presumes the end is the beginning. Programs of a political nature are important end products of social quality that can be effective only if the underlying structure of social values is right. The social values are right only if the individual values are right. The place to improve the world is first in one's own heart and head and hands, and then work outward from there. Other people can talk about how to expand the destiny of mankind. I just want to talk about how to fix a motorcycle. I think that what I have said has more lasting value. A town called Riggins comes up, and we see a lot of motels, and afterward the road branches away from the canyon and follows a smaller stream. It seems to head upward into forest. It does, and soon the road becomes shaded by tall, cool pines. Resort signs appear. We wind higher and higher into unexpectedly pleasant, cool, green meadows surrounded by pine forests. At a town called New Meadows, we fill up again and buy two cans of oil, still surprised at the change. But as we leave New Meadows, I note the long slant of the sun and a late afternoon depression begins to set in. At another time of day, these mountain meadows would refresh me more, but we've gone too long. We pass Tamarack, and the road drops down again from green meadows into dry, sandy country. I guess that's all I want to say for the Chautauqua today. It's been a long session, and perhaps the most important one. Tomorrow I want to talk about things that seem to turn one toward quality and turn one away from quality, some of the traps and problems that come up. Strange feelings from the orange sunlight on this sandy, dry country so far from home. I wonder if Chris feels it too. Just a sort of unexplained sadness that comes over each afternoon when the new day is gone forever and there's nothing ahead but increasing darkness. The orange turns to dull bronze light and continues to show what it has shown all day long, but now it seems to show it without enthusiasm. Across those dry hills, within those little houses in the distance, are people who've been there all day long, going about the business of the day, who now find nothing unusual or different in this strange darkening landscape as we do. If we were to come upon them early in the day, they might be curious about us and what we're here for. But now, in the evening, they'd just resent our presence. The workday is over. It's time for supper and family and relaxation and turning inward at home. We ride unnoticed down this empty highway through this strange country I've never seen before. And now a heavy feeling of isolation and loneliness becomes dominant, and my spirits wane with the sun. We stop in an abandoned schoolyard, and under a huge cottonwood tree I change the oil in the cycle. Chris is irritable and wonders why we stop for so long, not knowing perhaps that it's just the time of day that makes him irritable. But I give him the map to study while I change the oil, and when the oil is changed, we look at the map together, and decide to have supper at the next good restaurant we find and camp at the first good camping place. That cheers him up. At a town called Cambridge, we have supper, and when we are finished, it's dark out. We follow the headlight beam down a secondary road toward Oregon to a little sign saying Brownlee Campground, which appears to be in a draw of the mountains. In the dark, it's hard to tell what sort of country we're in. We follow a dirt road under trees and past underbrush to some campers' pull-ins. No one else seems to be here. When I shut the motor off and we unpack, I can hear a small stream nearby. Except for that and the chirping of some little bird, there's no sound.
I like it here, Chris says.
It's very quiet, I say.
Where will we be going tomorrow?
Into Oregon. I give him the flashlight and have him shine it where I'm unpacking.
Have I been there before?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I spread out the sleeping bags and put his on top of the picnic table. The novelty of this appeals to him. This night, there'll be no trouble sleeping. Soon I hear deep breathing that tells me he's already asleep. I wish I knew what to say to him, or what to ask. He seems so close at times, and yet the closeness has nothing to do with what is asked or said. Then at other times he seems very far away and sort of watching me from some vantage point I don't see. And then sometimes he's just childish and there's no relation at all. Sometimes, when thinking about this, I thought that the idea that one person's mind is accessible to another's is just a conversational illusion, just a figure of speech. An assumption that makes some kind of exchange between basically alien creatures seem plausible, and that really the relationship of one person to another is ultimately unknowable. The effort of fathoming what is in another's mind creates a distortion of what is seen. I'm trying, I suppose, for some situation in which whatever it is emerges undistorted. The way he asks all those questions, I don't know. Chapter 26. A sensation of cold wakes me up. I see out the top of the sleeping bag that the sky is dark gray. I pull my head down and close my eyes again. Later I see the gray of the sky is lighter, and it's still cold. I can see the vapor of my breath. An alarmed thought that the gray is from rain clouds overhead wakes me up, but after looking carefully I see that this is just gray dawn. It seems too cold and early to start riding yet, so I don't get out of the bag. But sleep is gone. Through the spokes of the motorcycle wheel, I see Chris's sleeping bag on the picnic table, twisted all around him. He isn't stirring. The cycle looms silently over me, ready to start, as if it has waited all night like some silent guardian. Silver gray and chrome and black and dusty. Dirt from Idaho and Montana and the Dakotas and Minnesota. From the ground up, it looks very impressive. No frills. Everything with a purpose. I don't think I'll ever sell it. No reason to, really. They're not like cars, with a body that rusts out in a few years. Keep them tuned and overhauled and they'll last as long as you do. Probably longer. Quality. It's carried us so far without trouble. The sunlight just touches the top of the bluff high above the draw we're in. A wisp of fog has appeared above the creek. That means it'll warm up. I get out of the sleeping bag, put shoes on, pack everything I can without waking Chris, and then go over to the picnic table and give him a shake to wake him up. He doesn't respond. I look around and see that there are no jobs left to do but wake him up, and hesitate, but feeling manic and jumpy from the brisk morning air, holler, "Wake!" And he sits up suddenly, eyes wide open. I do my best to follow this with the opening quatrain of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It looks like some desert cliff in Persia above us, but Chris doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about. He looks up at the top of the bluff, and then just sits there squinting at me. You have to be in a certain mood to accept bad recitations of poetry, particularly that one. Soon we're on the road again, which twists and turns. We stem down into an enormous canyon with high white bluffs on either side. The wind freezes. The road comes into some sunlight, which seems to warm me right through the jacket and sweater. But soon we ride into the shade of the canyon wall again, where again the wind freezes. This dry desert air doesn't hold heat. My lips, with the wind blowing into them, feel dry and cracked. Farther on, we cross a dam and leave the canyon into some high semi-desert country. This is Oregon now. The road winds through a landscape that reminds me of northern Rajasthan in India, where it's not quite desert, much pinyon, junipers, and grass, but not agricultural either, except where a draw or valley provides a little extra water. Those crazy Rubaiyat quatrains keep rumbling through my head. Something, something, along some strip of herbage strewn, that just divides the desert from the sown, where name of slave and sultan scarce is known, and pity Sultan Mahmud on his throne. That conjures up a glimpse of the ruins of an ancient Mughal palace, near the desert, where out of the corner of his eye he saw a wild rose bush. And this first summer month that brings the rose? How did that go? I don't know. I don't even like the poem. I've noticed since this trip has started, and particularly since Bozeman, that these fragments seem less and less a part of his memory, and more a part of mine. I'm not sure what that means, I think. I just don't know. I think there's a name for this kind of semi-desert, but I can't think of what it is. No one can be seen anywhere on the road but us. Chris hollers that he has diarrhea again. We ride until I see a stream below and pull off the road and stop. His face is full of embarrassment again, but I tell him we're in no hurry and get out a change of underwear and roll of toilet paper and bar of soap and tell him to wash his hands thoroughly and carefully after he's done. I sit on an Omar Khayyam rock contemplating the semi-desert and feel not bad. And this first summer month that brings the rose... Oh, now it comes back. Each morn a thousand roses brings, you say. Yes, but where leaves the rose of yesterday? And this first summer month that brings the rose shall take Jamshid and Kaikobad away. And so on and so forth. Let's get off Omar and onto the Chautauqua. Omar's solution is just to sit around and guzzle the wine and feel so bad that time is passing. And the Chautauqua looks good to me by comparison. Particularly today's Chautauqua, which is about gumption. I see Chris coming back up the hill now. His expression looks happy. I like the word gumption because it's so homely and so forlorn and so out of style it looks as if it needs a friend and isn't likely to reject anyone who comes along. It's an old Scottish word, once used a lot by pioneers, but which, like kin, seems to have all but dropped out of use. I like it also because it describes exactly what happens to someone who connects with quality. He gets filled with gumption. The Greeks called it enthusiasmos, the root of enthusiasm, which means literally filled with theos, or God, or quality. See how that fits? A person filled with gumption doesn't sit around dissipating and stewing about things. He's at the front of the train of his own awareness, watching to see what's up the track, and meeting it when it comes. That's gumption. Chris arrives and says, I'm feeling better now. Good, I say. We pack up the soap and toilet paper and put the towel and wet underwear, where they won't get other things damp, and then we get on and are moving again. The gumption-filling process occurs when one is quiet long enough to see and hear and feel the real universe, not just one's own stale opinions about it. But it's nothing exotic. That's why I like the word. You see it often in people who return from long, quiet fishing trips. Often they're a little defensive about having put so much time to no account because there's no intellectual justification for what they've been doing. But the returned fisherman usually has a peculiar abundance of gumption, usually for the very same things he was sick to death of weeks before. He hasn't been wasting time. It's only our limited cultural viewpoint that makes it seem so. If you're going to repair a motorcycle, an adequate supply of gumption is the first and most important tool. If you haven't got that, you might as well gather up all the other tools and put them away because they won't do you any good. Gumption is the psychic gasoline that keeps the whole thing going. If you haven't got it, there's no way the motorcycle can possibly be fixed. But if you have got it, and know how to keep it, there's absolutely no way in this whole world that motorcycle can keep from getting fixed. It's bound to happen. Therefore, the thing that must be monitored at all times and preserved before anything else is the gumption. This paramount importance of gumption solves a problem of format of this Chautauqua. The problem has been how to get off the generalities. If the Chautauqua gets into the actual details of fixing one individual machine, the chances are overwhelming that it won't be your make and model, and the information will be not only useless, but dangerous, since information that fixes one model can sometimes wreck another. For detailed information of an objective sort, a separate shop manual for the specific make and model of machine must be used. In addition, a general shop manual, such as Autel's Automotive Guide, fills in the gaps. But there's another kind of detail that no shop manual goes into, but that is common to all machines and can be given here. This is the detail of the quality relationship, the gumption relationship, between the machine and the mechanic, which is just as intricate as the machine itself. Throughout the process of fixing the machine, things always come up. Low-quality things, from a dusted knuckle to an accidentally ruined, irreplaceable assembly. These drain off gumption, destroy enthusiasm, and leave you so discouraged you want to forget the whole business. I call these things gumption traps. There are hundreds of different kinds of gumption traps, maybe thousands, maybe millions. I have no way of knowing how many I don't know. I know it seems as though I've stumbled into every kind of gumption trap imaginable. What keeps me from thinking I've hit them all is that with every job I discover more. Motorcycle maintenance gets frustrating, angering, infuriating. That's what makes it interesting. The map before me says the town of Baker is soon ahead. I see we're in better agricultural land now. More rain here. What I have in mind now is a catalog of gumption traps I have known. I want to start a whole new academic field, gumptionology, in which these traps are sorted, classified, structured into hierarchies, and interrelated for the edification of future generations and the benefit of all mankind. Gumptionology 101, an examination of affective, cognitive, and psychomotor blocks in the perception of quality relationships. 3 credits, 7th hour, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I'd like to see that in a college catalog somewhere. In traditional maintenance, gumption is considered something you're born with or have acquired as a result of good upbringing. It's a fixed commodity. From the lack of information about how one acquires this gumption, one might assume that a person without any gumption is a hopeless case. In non-dualistic maintenance, gumption isn't a fixed commodity. It's variable, a reservoir of good spirits that can be added to or subtracted from. Since it's a result of the perception of quality, a gumption trap, consequently, can be defined as anything that causes one to lose sight of quality, and thus lose one's enthusiasm for what one is doing. As one might guess from a definition as broad as this, the field is enormous, and only a beginning sketch can be attempted here. As far as I can see, there are two main types of gumption traps. The first type are those in which you're thrown off the quality track by conditions that arise from external circumstances, and I call these setbacks. The second type are traps in which you're thrown off the quality track by conditions that are primarily within yourself. These I don't have any generic name for. Hang-ups, I suppose. I'll take the externally caused setbacks first. The first time you do any major job, it seems as though the out-of-sequence reassembly setback is your biggest worry. This occurs usually at a time when you think you're almost done. After days of work, you finally have it all together except for... what's this? A connecting rod bearing liner? How could you have left that out? Oh, Jesus. Everything's got to come apart again. You can almost hear the gumption escaping. There's nothing you can do but go back and take it all apart again, after a rest period of up to a month that allows you to get used to the idea. There are two techniques I use to prevent the out-of-sequence reassembly setback. I use them mainly when I'm getting into a complex assembly I don't know anything about. It should be inserted here, parenthetically, that there's a school of mechanical thought which says I shouldn't be getting into a complex assembly I don't know anything about. I should have training or leave the job to a specialist. That's a self-serving school of mechanical eliteness I'd like to see wiped out. That was a specialist who broke the fins on this machine. I've edited manuals written to train specialists for IBM, and what they know when they're done isn't that great. You're at a disadvantage the first time around, and it may cost you a little more because of parts you accidentally damage, and it will almost undoubtedly take a lot more time. But the next time around, you're way ahead of the specialist. You, with gumption, have learned the assembly the hard way, and you've a whole set of good feelings about it that he's unlikely to have. Anyway, the first technique for preventing the out-of-sequence reassembly gumption trap is a notebook in which I write down the order of disassembly and note anything unusual that might give trouble in reassembly later on. This notebook gets plenty grease-smeared and ugly, but a number of times one or two words in it that didn't seem important when written down have prevented damage and saved hours of work. The notes should pay special attention to left-hand and right-hand and up-and-down orientations of parts, and color coding, and positions of wires. If incidental parts look worn or damaged or loose, this is the time to note it so that you can make all your parts purchases at the same time. The second technique for preventing the out-of-sequence reassembly gumption trap is newspapers opened out on the floor of the garage, on which all the parts are laid left to right and top to bottom in the order in which you read a page. That way, when you put it back together in reverse order, the little screws and washers and pins that can be easily overlooked are brought to your attention as you need them. Even with all these precautions, however, out-of-sequence reassemblies sometimes occur, and when they do, you've got to watch the gumption. Watch out for gumption desperation, in which you hurry up wildly in an effort to restore gumption by making up for lost time. That just creates more mistakes. When you first see that you have to go back and take it apart all over again, it's definitely time for that long break. It's important to distinguish from these the reassemblies that were out of sequence because you lacked certain information. Frequently, the whole reassembly process becomes a cut-and-try technique in which you have to take it apart to make a change and then put it together again to see if the change works. If it doesn't work, that isn't a setback because the information gained is real progress. But if you've made just a plain old dumb mistake in reassembly, some gumption can still be salvaged by the knowledge that the second disassembly and reassembly is likely to go much faster than the first one. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. But if you've made just a plain old dumb mistake in reassembly, some gumption can still be salvaged by the knowledge that the second disassembly and reassembly is likely to go much faster than the first one. You've unconsciously memorized all sorts of things you won't have to relearn. From Baker, the cycle has taken us up through forests. The forest road takes us through a pass and down through more forests on the other side. As we move again down the side of the mountain, we see the trees thin out even more until we are in desert again. The intermittent failure setback is next. In this, the thing that is wrong becomes right all of a sudden, just as you start to fix it. Electrical short circuits are often in this class. The short occurs only when the machine's bouncing around. As soon as you stop, everything's okay. It's almost impossible to fix it then. All you can do is try to get it to go wrong again, and if it won't, forget it. Intermittents become gumption traps when they fool you into thinking you've really got the machine fixed. It's always a good idea on any job to wait a few hundred miles before coming to that conclusion. They're discouraging when they crop up again and again, but when they do, you're no worse off than someone who goes to a commercial mechanic. In fact, you're better off. They're much more of a gumption trap for the owner who has to drive his machine to the shop again and again and never get satisfaction. On your own machine, you can study them over a long period of time, something a commercial mechanic can't do, and you can just carry around the tools you think you'll need until the intermittent happens again. And then, when it happens, stop and work on it. When intermittents recur, try to correlate them with other things the cycle is doing. Do the misfires, for example, occur only on bumps, only on turns, only on acceleration, only on hot days? These correlations are clues for cause and effect hypotheses. In some intermittents, you have to resign yourself to a long fishing expedition. But no matter how tedious that gets, it's never as tedious as taking the machine to a commercial mechanic 5 times. I'm tempted to go into long detail about intermittents I have known, with a blow-by-blow description of how these were solved. But this gets like those fishing stories, of interest mainly to the fisherman, who doesn't quite catch on to why everyone yawns. He enjoyed it. Next to misassemblies and intermittents, I think the most common external gumption trap is the parts setback. Here a person who does his own work can get depressed in a number of ways. Parts are something you never plan on buying when you originally get the machine. Dealers like to keep their inventories small. Wholesalers are slow and always understaffed in the spring when everybody buys motorcycle parts. The pricing on parts is the second part of this gumption trap. It's a well-known industrial policy to price the original equipment competitively, because the customer can always go somewhere else. But on parts, to overprice and clean up. The price of the part is not only jacked up way beyond its new price, you get a special price because you're not a commercial mechanic. This is a sly arrangement that allows the commercial mechanic to get rich by putting in parts that aren't needed. One more hurdle yet. The part may not fit. Parts lists always contain mistakes. Make and model changes are confusing. Out-of-tolerance parts runs sometimes get through quality control because there's no operating checkout at the factory. Some of the parts you buy are made by specialty houses who don't have access to the engineering data needed to make them right. Sometimes they get confused about make and model changes. Sometimes the parts man you're dealing with jots down the wrong number. Sometimes you don't give him the right identification. But it's always a major gumption trap to get all the way home and discover that a new part won't work. The parts traps may be overcome by a combination of a number of techniques. First, if there's more than one supplier in town, by all means, choose the one with the most cooperative parts man. Get to know him on a first-name basis. Often he will have been a mechanic once himself, and can provide a lot of information you need. Keep an eye out for price cutters and give them a try. Some of them have good deals. Auto stores and mail-order houses frequently stock the commoner cycle parts at prices way below those of the cycle dealers. You can buy roller chain from chain manufacturers, for example, at way below the inflated cycle shop prices. Always take the old part with you to prevent getting a wrong part. Take along some machinist's calipers for comparing dimensions. Finally, if you're as exasperated as I am by the parts problem, and have some money to invest, you can take up the really fascinating hobby of machining your own parts. I have a little 6x18-inch lathe with a milling attachment and a full complement of welding equipment, arc, hella-arc, gas, and mini-gas, for this kind of work. With the welding equipment, you can build up worn surfaces with better-than-original metal and then machine it back to tolerance with carbide tools. You can't really believe how versatile that lathe plus milling plus welding arrangement is until you've used it. If you can't do the job directly, you can always make something that will do it. The work of machining a part is very slow, and some parts, such as ball bearings, you're never going to machine. But you'd be amazed at how you can modify parts designs so that you can make them with your equipment, and the work isn't nearly as slow or frustrating as a wait for some smirking parts man to send away to the factory. And the work is gumption building, not gumption destroying. To run a cycle with parts in it you've made yourself gives you a special feeling you can't possibly get from strictly store-bought parts. We've come to the sage and sand of the desert, and the engine started to sputter. I switch to the reserve gas tank and study the map. We fill up at a town called Unity, and down the hot black road, through the sagebrush we go. Well, those were the commonest setbacks I can think of. Out-of-sequence reassembly, intermittent failure, and parts problems. But although setbacks are the commonest gumption traps, they're only the external cause of gumption loss. Time now to consider some of the internal gumption traps that operate at the same time. As the course description of gumptionology indicated, this internal part of the field can be broken down into three main types of internal gumption traps. Those that block affective understanding, called value traps, those that block cognitive understanding, called truth traps, and those that block psychomotor behavior, called muscle traps. The value traps are by far the largest and the most dangerous group. Of the value traps, the most widespread and pernicious is value rigidity. This is an inability to revalue what one sees because of commitment to previous values. In motorcycle maintenance, you must rediscover what you do as you go. Rigid values make this impossible. The typical situation is that the motorcycle doesn't work. The facts are there, but you don't see them. You're looking right at them, but you don't yet have enough value. This is what Phaedrus was talking about. Quality, value, creates the subjects and objects of the world. The facts do not exist until value has created them. If your values are rigid, you can't really learn new facts. This often shows up in premature diagnosis, when you're sure you know what the trouble is, and then when it isn't, you're stuck. Then you've got to find some new clues, but before you can find them, you've got to clear your head of old opinions. If you're plagued with value rigidity, you can fail to see the real answer even when it's staring you right in the face because you can't see the new answer's importance. The birth of a new fact is always a wonderful thing to experience. It's dualistically called a discovery because of the presumption that it has an existence independent of anyone's awareness of it. When it comes along, it always has, at first, a low value. Then, depending on the value looseness of the observer and the potential quality of the fact, its value increases, either slowly or rapidly, or the value wanes and the fact disappears. The overwhelming majority of facts, the sights and sounds that are around us every second, and the relationships among them, and everything in our memory, these have no quality, in fact, have a negative quality. If they were all present at once, our consciousness would be so jammed with meaningless data we couldn't think or act. So we pre-select on the basis of quality, or to put it Phaedrus's way, the track of quality pre-selects what data we're going to be conscious of, and it makes this selection in such a way as to best harmonize what we are with what we are becoming. What you have to do, if you get caught up in this gumption trap of value rigidity, is slow down. You're going to have to slow down anyway, whether you want to or not. But slow down deliberately and go over ground that you've been over before to see if the things you thought were important were really important, and to, well, just stare at the machine. There's nothing wrong with that. Just live with it for a while. Watch it the way you watch a line when fishing. And before long, as sure as you live, you'll get a little nibble. A little fact, asking in a timid, humble way if you're interested in it. That's the way the world keeps on happening. Be interested in it. At first, try to understand this new fact, not so much in terms of your big problem, as for its own sake. That problem may not be as big as you think it is. And that fact may not be as small as you think it is. It may not be the fact that you want, but at least you should be very sure of that before you send the fact away. Often before you send it away, you will discover it has friends who are right next to it, and are watching to see what your response is. Among the friends may be the exact fact you are looking for. After a while, you may find that the nibbles you get are more interesting than your original purpose of fixing the machine. When that happens, you've reached a kind of point of arrival. Then you're no longer strictly a motorcycle mechanic. You're also a motorcycle scientist, and you've completely conquered the gumption trap of value rigidity. The road has come up into the pines again, but I see by the map that it won't be for long. There are some resort billboards along the road and some kids beneath them, almost as if part of the advertisement, gathering pine cones. They wave, and in doing so, the littlest boy drops all his cones. I keep wanting to go back to that analogy of fishing for facts. I can just see somebody asking, with great frustration, "Yes, but which facts do you fish for? There's got to be more to it than that." But the answer is that if you know which facts you're fishing for, you're no longer fishing. You've caught them. I'm trying to think of a specific example. All kinds of examples from cycle maintenance could be given, but the most striking example of value rigidity I can think of is the old South Indian monkey trap, which depends